This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Magnan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumablet.
And our topic this week is...
Performant Core Database Applications.
Cool, but first we have some follow-up.
Yes, we do. So for this week I have two items, and the first one is about one of my favorite topic, CarPlay. Because it is one of my favorite topic, it also has been quite recurrent throughout of our history. The last time I spoke about it was in the end quite a while ago, ignoring our WWDC extravaganza, and it was on episode 84. It's pronounced Waze, where I tried to reimagine CarPlay. I know you like this title. And it's funny because in relation of that episode where I tried to reimagine CarPlay and the recent, well, the last 6 months, Apple's announcement of a new generation of CarPlay, I'll be a bit pessimistic, but I was kind of optimistic. And that's my way of saying I was not expecting some of the early CarPlay partners to drop out of CarPlay. And that's literally where the news comes from and this follow-up items comes in. So on March 31st, Reuters reported that GM, General Motors, will stop delivering cars, and especially electric cars, with CarPlay support. The first car that's going to be impacted with this change of heart, if we say so, is the 2024 Chevrolet Blazer EV. This announcement also impacts Android Auto. So more or less, they're literally stopping to support any phone projection OSs, is the verbiage that GM uses in their press release. They're going to go all in with their own infotainment system based on... And they're not really clear, they just say it comes from Google, but a Google infotainment system. And I personally assume here they don't want to say Android Automotive, but these kind of mean Android Automotive. I'll go with a small quote of the Reuters article because it is quite telling. Buyers of GM EVs with the new systems will get access to Google Map and Google Assistant at no extra cost for 8 years, GM said. GM said the future of infotainment system will offer applications such as Spotify Music Service, Audible, and other services that many drivers now access via smartphone. So yeah, they do that because they want more control, and also they want to sell you this fucking system at some point. Oh yeah, we're happy, you won't charge for it for the next 8 years, but guess what? At some point, somebody have to pay for it. So in the show notes, I'll include a link to the Reuters article and to the The Verge article, because the The Verge has the official kind of press release in PDF form in it. And my personal opinion of this is it's quite a downgrade, especially coming from GM, which was a car manufacturer that jumped quite early in the CarPlay support game. So I know that GM, they're trying to spin this news and things like that, that, oh, having our own system is going to be good for users. But in the end, it's going to be good for them because it's going to give them access to your data in some fashion. Like, they'll know what you listen to Spotify because that's how I'm sure they'll authorize Spotify to run on their own system. And it's funny, like, GM has mentioned it, that they want to have access to that. One of their other reasons, they say, oh, now that we have our own system, it will be more important for EV range and custom in-app navigation. So kind of using those bullshit arguments. And again, I mentioned, they are also expecting to increase their subscription revenues in the coming decade, if I recall correctly. So again, even if it come at an extra no cost for the first 8 years, they do expect that at some point somebody will pay to get access to their own system and you'll be stuck.
Yeah, and the episode of Upgrade I was listening to where they were talking about this, it was mentioned that GM is also the company that gave us OnStar, which, yes, like, they must not be very happy about these phones coming in and basically, like, nullifying any reason for anyone to sign up to OnStar because their phone does everything OnStar does better.
Agreed. And even now with crash detection, I think that will be maybe the last remnant, yeah, of OnStar that was worth it, is, you know what, like, it was connected to any sensor and it would detect crashes. And it's funny that you mentioned Upgrade because I've also included a link from sixcolor.com where Jason Snell described his own opinion about the news, and I quite agree with his take, so worth the read. And in literally just before I was preparing for recording this week's episode, Jason also linked on Mastodon a post from 9to5Mac about the Rivian CEO's performance, or I guess interview, part of MKBHD's Waveform podcast, where he tried to justify why Rivian is not supporting CarPlay and all of that. While I can get behind some of the argument that was mentioned in this 9to5 article, I didn't listen to the podcast, but I think most of these arguments were around like controlling the user experience, and we're able to ship like weekly updates to the car infotainment or the car software at this point for Rivian. I think it is kind of downplaying the fact that CarPlay runs on your phone and your life nowadays is on your phone. So having another computer to deal with and to have to sync data from and to, and that's a point that Jason Stell mentioned in his Six Color article, is a tedious process. So I hope that both GM and at some point Rivian will change mine on CarPlay. And I'm really eager to see what is coming with CarPlay and the new generation of CarPlay, and what will be the impact with all the current manufacturer that supports it, and see if others will start to jump ship on those car phone projection system. You'll see that this week my follow-up items are quite car focused. My next follow-up item is related to episode 177, My Brain Says Yes, My Heart Says No, where I explored self-driving technology levels to better understand what the future holds. On March 29, Bill Gates, yes, Bill Gates, posted on his personal blog. First, I didn't know he had a personal blog. And two, the name is pretty funny. It's called Gates Notes.
Oh, of course, it's cringe. It's Bill Gates.
Yes, exactly. And he posted about his personal beliefs of what the future holds for self-driving car / autonomous car. He believes, and I quote, that we will reach a tipping point within the next decade. One part of the blog post that is quite funny to me is he based his first explanation on the SAE levels that we went through and described in episode 177. And he also has a graphic showing a gauge, in a typical gauge, cluster gauge, showing the five levels. And he mentions that currently we're close to, but not yet at level three, even if some people want you to believe otherwise. And I think overall in this post, that is about a 5-minute read, so well worth going in the show notes and going to read it. I think he has an interesting take about the future, one of which, well, I quote, is AVs are rapidly reaching the point where almost all of the tech required has been invented. And he also described the impacts it will have in our society in the years to come. So, great recommendation. I strongly suggest you go watch it, read it, if you're curious like me about autonomous car. That's it for my follow-up. What's yours, Yannick?
I have some follow-up for episode 179, The Vibe, The Structure, The Journey, which was about Gran Turismo 7, which launched a year ago. On the past episode, I mentioned that now the game has PSVR, but a new patch has come out since that, which adds 120Hz modes to the game. And of course, since I have a PS5 and a 120Hz capable monitor, I jumped on the opportunity to try it and very quickly realized I didn't actually understand these modes at all. And I ended up watching a Digital Foundry video that I'm going to put in the show notes, which I highly recommend anyone who is confused by these video modes to go watch it. And so just to give some quick background, like, I was under the impression that the video modes on the PS5, you had a ray tracing mode and you had a frame rate mode, that ultimately the only difference between these two modes would be during replays. You could choose 30 FPS ray traced or 60 FPS non-ray traced, and everything else in the game would run at 60 frames per second without ray tracing. Apparently this stopped being true at some point. Like, I didn't know this Very important note, I guess. Apparently, like, the video modes, what they did, changed at some point. And with the 120 hertz support enabled, all the modes are 120 hertz to some degree. So you have the ray tracing mode, which you can enable and get up to 120 hertz, although it will drop to some degree, like around 100 somewhat regularly. And there is the frame rate mode, which is pretty much a locked 120 frames per second, which is pretty impressive. The downside, of course, being that you're going to be running at a much lower resolution, and it's visibly lower. You can very quickly tell that stuff in the distance is much fuzzier than it is in the other one. Where this is especially juicy is if you have a variable refresh rate monitor, because this means you can run the VRR enabled modes for this, and this means they bump the resolution even more in these cases, because even if your frame rate drops to like 90 frames per second, your display will be able to make it look fluid, whereas if you were running at a locked 120 hertz cadence, it would look juddery. It would look less juddery than, let's say, if you were running at 40 frames per second from a 60 FPS target frame rate, but it would still look juddery. So I tried all of these modes. I mean, I tried both modes with VRR on because I didn't want to disable VRR. And I was... so it, originally, I had just tried it by just flipping the switch to 120 hertz. And it stayed in whatever video mode I was on by default. So I was in ray tracing mode because, again, I just assumed that this only impacted stuff outside of gameplay. So I always had it set to ray tracing mode just so I could see the pretty effects when I was in the menus and stuff. What I didn't realize is that now with the 120 hertz thing, like, this was also enabled during gameplay. And so because of that, I didn't actually realize that it was working properly. which tells you how subtle the effect is to some degree. So with VRR on and all that stuff, I was hitting target frame rates of around 90, 95. And honestly, I did not notice that big of a difference in the smoothness of the gameplay with that jump in frame rate. And I think part of that is because I play Bumpercam. And in Bumpercam, you're sort of limited by how fast your car can turn. And so it's not really going to be that much smoother, not significantly so anyway, if you just go up to 90 or whatever. So later on, I came back during the week, and I actually it was earlier today, and I tried both modes one after the other. And I can tell you that the prioritized frame rate mode, which pretty much always locks the 120 FPS, you can feel the difference a lot more, but it comes at a significant downgrade in quality. So I would not recommend it. Everyone is pretty much saying, like, if you want to play with these 120 hertz modes, you basically have no reason to use anything but the ray tracing mode, unless you are a hyper competitive esports gamer, in which case you probably want the frame rate mode. And I kind of agree with that. It just looks incredibly smooth. It runs at a native 4K. It runs better than GT7 has ever run on that hardware. It's really just like they took all of the VR optimizations and they enabled it outside of VR, and you get this really good high-performance version of GT7, which I would recommend. It's just, don't expect going into it that you're going to be, like, blown away by the extra smoothness, because, honestly, it's not that big a deal. I probably wouldn't have known if I had done a side-by-side test, honestly. But hey, it's there. It's cool that I get to use my fancy hardware. It's just not the greatest example. Give me more first-person shooters with 120 hertz modes, and I'll take it. Apex Legends has said that they are working on a 120 FPS mode for the PS5, and I'm very much looking forward to that, because that is going to be awesome. And Destiny 2 has a 120 hertz mode, and that is transformative for multiplayer. So I think, like, first-person shooters are a great demo of what 120 hertz can do in terms of smoothness. Gran Turismo, not so much. And that's it for me.
Good. So let's jump into the main topic. So this week, I'm going back to a developer-focused topic. So if you're maybe less familiar with developing iOS app, there might be a lot of unknown vocabulary. But still, I strongly suggest you keep listening because app performance is a fun topic. And I hope that you will think that too. So out of my decade, and oh man, I feel old when I say this, but that's kind of true, of professional experience developing iOS app, most of it, give or take about 8 years at this point, I've been working on core data backed application. In this time period, I've seen and worked on with different style of said application and with different architecture using core data. But there has still been similar recurring performance issue linked to core data, how it was used in the app, and again, its persistent layer. So this week, we'll look into a couple of tips to improve your performance of your core data-backed application. And the reason I want to share those tips is because core data as a framework, it's pretty complex. It's quite easy to shoot yourself in the foot and mess things up because there are limited guardrails put in place for you as a developer. So the idea is, let's see if we can try to put some guardrails to ensure that we do the right things. I do have a funny story regarding core data and the fact that we always find it complex, but we still use it a lot, is at work. And it even came from friend of the show, Chuck Schneider. The nickname was Box of Snake, and represented by the packaging or the package emoji, which is the package box, and the snake emoji. So every time we had to complain about core data, the Box of Snake emojis would come into Slack, that's for sure. Okay, so let's jump into the tips for this week. So tip number one, and I nicknamed it, don't cross the threads. In my previous core data episodes, I've talked in great length about NS manage object context. And this object is the base of how you access data or you do any operation in a core data world. This object has internal concurrency considerations that you need to think about when working with it. When create a new instance of this object in your application, you need to tell it which type of dispatch or concurrency you want it to be attached to. While it is pretty straightforward to get data out of a context object, it is also a bit too easy to share that data, to pass this data around in your application, which might mean that you end up crossing those dispatch queue or in the end, those threads. And doing this can create important performance impact, and the way you can do that also makes it easy to ignore the consequences of such operation. Going back to creating an NSManageObject context instance, it defines what it calls a concurrency type enumeration, which contains two values. The first one is called main queue, and the second one is called private queue. The main queue value means that all the persistence operation for this context will be executed on the app's main queue. Private queue, on the other end, means that core data will internally create its own queue for this context and execute all the persistence operation on that queue for this context. So it means that the more instances you have in your application, the more you can fine-tune them. Some could be attached to the main queue. Some others, depending on the nature of the operation they do, can be attached to a private queue. I use the word queue here, and especially the main queue. And if you've ever worked with iOS or Mac application and developing them, the main queue is a familiar concept. While there's no direct correlation between threads and queues in a Mac app platform and iOS app platform, for the main queue, there is more or less, it's attached to the main thread. So everything you run on it will run on the main thread. You might have heard a lot when you read about development of iOS application that the main thread is important because a lot of things happen on it, and mainly all of the UI operations and our UI processes by default are run on it. So it does mean that on a big application, there has been a lot of things happening on that said thread. You for sure don't want to end up in a place where either the main thread or the main queue is blocked because it's waiting to fetch data from disk. Because if this queue or thread is blocked, it means that it can no longer process other operations, other inputs, outputs that comes from the UI, which means you might end up with a buggy application or a laggy application because your UI won't be responsive. In that case, that's when you might be tempted to create an NS manage object context instance with a privacy queue, with a private queue concurrency type. And that would be a good call. Unless, again, now we go back to the theme of this tip, which is don't cross the thread. Don't cross the threads if you start sharing the results in between threads. And that might be an habit that you do naturally because, again, you get the data from the background queue or the private queue. And then the idea is this data, you want to show it on a UI or on a screen. But by doing that, you end up taking those NSManage object instances created in a private queue and bringing them in the main queue. And that is considered an unsafe operation, which creates undefined behavior. And for sure, if you've ever developed any type of application, here I'm not talking about iOS and Mac, just any type of application, you might not like to hear those words, undefined behavior or unsafe operation. So the idea is not to do that. And one way to fix this issue is that when you know that a long-standing fetch operation will happen, you should not ask it to return you the data, but to return you what we call an NSManageObjectID. So it's an identifier that represents the object in a core data system, and those are saved to pass across thread. So this way you can do your background operations in a private queue, process all the objects or get from the system all the objects you really need to do to get based on your business logic, pass them in the main queue, and in the main queue, just ask, give me all the objects which have these object IDs, and then really get the data from the main queue. So you really minimize the type of operation that's happening. One of them is just like computing which object you want to show, and then the other one is just fetching the data regarding those. If I quickly come back on unsafe operation and undefined behavior, especially when using an NSManageObject instance across threads, you might just realize that when you run your application, it kind of just works. So part of your debugging session, parts of your testing session, you might not realize that you've broken this assumption that you might be using data from one thread in another or using an NSManageObject context from attached to one private queue, to one queue in another queue. And that's because the system, to go back to my guardrails quote, the system has nothing on by default to tell you about this issue and to make sure that you are aware of this broken assumption that you just broke. So in the end, you might end up shipping your application with that issue. Crossing the threads leads to unexpected behavior, which leads to a higher possibility of crashes. And the issue with those crashes when they happen in the wild is that they are likely to happen at the least expected spot in your code base. So possibly 3 to 4 calls later or a different operation on the core out of the stack that will happen later in the application's lifecycle will try to get executed, and then boom, you crash with a weird debug trace, or you receive a crash and it's the crash reason on your crash analytics tool makes no sense. So in the end, those issues are really hard to debug. You end up with complex or incomplete or hard to decipher or a mix of all those three stack traces. And in the end, you end up with an app that has shipped to customer, which does not deliver on its promise. And even worse than that, sometimes you're not even able to reproduce it internally. So to me, this is far from what I consider a performant application, because you cannot literally rely on it because it crashes at random places. So to keep in mind that to fix those problems, there are, we'll see, debug tools that can help you on that, but there are more of a, we need to create our own guardrails to ensure we don't do that. You'll have to change a bit your architecture, or especially if you're using more modern core data tools like NS Persistent Container, you can use what Apple provides to you to stay on the safe side. So to solve this issue where you might bring data from one queue to another, I hope that your core data code is not older or was not architected before iOS 10, because if it wasn't and was created more recently, chances are that you followed the recommendation, or you followed Apple's recommendation, or a lot of the blogs out there are people teaching core data, and you are using NS Persistent Container. And this is an object that I've brought up multiple times in our previous core data episode, because it is Apple's flag in the ground on how a core data architecture in an app, or also referred as a core data stack, should be made. And NS Persistent Container provides two important APIs to solve this crossing the thread issue. First, it provides you with a property named ViewContext, which returns a properly configured instance of NSManageContext, which its sole job, according to what Apple really wants you to do and guidelines that I think you should put in place in your app, is literally from the ViewContext you should only read data, and its concurrency is attached to the main queue. Because the idea is the data you get out of that context, which again goes back to your persistence layer, is expected to be, I want to get the data out of the system and then massage it so it ends up in my UI. Related to that is, I strongly suggest to never do any other types of operation on the view context from NS Persistent Container. If you need to do any other of the CRUD operations, so we said that the view context is for read-only, so the other CUD, create, update, or delete, you should use other APIs that NS Persistent Container offers to you. And there are two other APIs that can do that for you. The first one, and you'll see they are on the same team, of using another type of context, which Apple for NS Persistent Container uses the background. So if you hear me say private queue, background queue, that's kind of why, because they kind of mix both words throughout their API. So the API I'm referring to on NS Persistent Container is a function called perform background task, which is a closure-based API. So it's a function you call and you provide it a closure with the expected parameter in that closure be the newly created NS Manage Object Context with its concurrency type set to the private queue and created for you by the system. The other API that gives you the same flexibility, but I think gives you even more flexibility, is the function called new background context. And the main difference between those two is in perform background task, because it's closure based, you are expected to do your operation inside that closure. So the manage object context you receive inside the closure, you cannot capture it and store it in a property. Like, you should do your operation in it and then let it die. For sure, make sure that you save your operation so that it gets saved on disk in your backing layer. But the idea is, when you exit this closure, by exiting the closure, it's saying the system, I am done doing my background task. Whereas with new background context, since the system returns you the properly configured background NSManage object context, it is your job to manually manage the lifecycle of this object. So you have a bit more flexibility, but still, whether you use the quote-unquote fully manual, which is what I call the new background context function, or the perform background task function, the idea is your create, update, and delete operation should be performed on an NSManage object context, which has the concurrency type set to private, and that's what Apple does for you behind your back on those APIs. Lastly, when using NS Persistence Container, you also should use you should make sure that in your business logic and in the data model you want to store in Core Data, that there's a unique way to identify all the objects. So let's say you have a car and then you have a garage, so that you have a unique ID to say, okay, my garage one can only have one object representation in my persistence layer, so that you don't have to deal with object uniqueness yourself. And this persistent container is really well suited to those tools. If your application as a stack that was created before the release of an NS persistent container, you'll have to manage yourself all types of NS manage object context instances yourself, whether they are main queue attached, they are the private queue attached. It is your job to do that, because that's kind of what Core Data life was before NS persistent container. There was no flag in the ground like Apple says, here's what we think Core Data stack should look like. I think one of the approach I would suggest here is to kind of create your own version of NS persistent container, or try to migrate to it. But I can understand that it might be a bit harder if you do have a Core Data stack that's been running for the past, at this point, if it was created before iOS 10, it will be like six or seven years.
Something tells me if you're running a stack that old and you're still doing it and you're not seeing significant problems, you probably dealt with those problems already.
Fair. And I do have an app in mind that I worked on, and that's the issue. It's like a lot of the performance issue we dealt with, or we were forced to not deal with it, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we end up doing, is because it was created before NS persistent container existed, we kind of have our own object that kind of closely does that for us, which replicates API or describe the same. Okay, I have different function that can factory out some NS manage object context instances assigned to the right dispatch queue, so that we can manage their lifecycle ourselves while having some of the niceties that came from those API. Or again, if you were to read, I won't say old Core Data guidelines, but just a lot of what people have written in the past 15, 20 years on Core Data, even when it was on the Mac, you kind of quickly realize that NS persistent container was kind of like one of the general consensus of how you would build a Core Data application and how you would build such an object that factories out NS manage object context instances for your need of creating, reading, like for CRUD operations in that persistent system. Last up on what I considered old Core Data stack, I think those are the ones that will need the most auditing, I think it's the best way to say it, because I cannot give you a blank recommendation here. I think for NS persistent container, because it ships with the framework, this is you to say like, okay, yes, even if you can do create, update, and delete operations from the view context, I strongly suggest that you do not, that you use the other APIs, whereas you would have to audit what you have in your code base currently to see how you can adapt it and possibly try to fit the new pattern so that maybe later down the road you can completely switch to NS persistent container. Okay, all of this brings me up to the first debug flag I want to talk to you this week. And the idea behind this debug flag is that you want to figure out a way to detect those concurrency issues. Because even if you do your best job as developers or as a team of developers, you might do a mistake. You might not realize it that you're doing a create operation from the view context. And like I mentioned at the beginning, Cortana doesn't have default guardrails against those issues, but it does offer a tool to help you detect such problem. I think one of the main issues with this debug tool and another one we'll see later on is that they are too new to exist unless you're, I guess, I don't want to say me, but you're like me, which I means like you read a lot of the core data documentation or you end up being assigned on a lot of the core data problems. So you do keep an eye on what's announced at WWDC or again, read the existing or the archive documentation extensively when you do research about such problems. The main reason why those debug tools are to find is because the way to enable them are hidden behind the argument passes on launch feature of a Xcode. So they're literally like command line tool arguments that you pass into your application. So let's talk about this one. And it is a mouthful because it is com.apple.coredata.currencydebug.1. So just imagine that the first part is separated by a space. I will kindly include the link in the show notes to one of the appropriate session describing this flag so that you can also see it visually and you also see the steps that I will kindly glance at today on how to enable or where to look at in your project schema to add this. But the idea behind this flag is when Core Data detects a concurrency issue, when you run your code, it will throw an Objective-C exception that will literally crash the application. So the best way to figure this out is you enable it, you run your application attached to the debugger, and you just go through the flow that you expect, or you just run through flows. You really test your app. And when a crashes occur, you'll see that the stack trace of the Tron exception will quickly show you the code that has accessed the information of wrong thread. So you don't know which thread or which part of your code base have give this other part of the code base that's now crashing the information from a bad thread, but at least you know which code part of my code base is using information that it shall not be using. So at that point you'll need to debug to figure out where this data comes from, but at least it is better than just trying to figure the problem out by having no tools, because now you can quickly just run through a user flow, let's say, and then boom, after a certain step in your application, the application crashes. So at least you do have a clearer path. Oh, I've done X, Y, and Z, and then boom, it crashes. So I can quickly go back and look at the code paths that leads me to this X, Y, and Z. Lastly, on this flag, I strongly suggest that you go in your Xcode iOS project and you configure your project schema to have this flag defined, but keep it disabled. And I'll try to draw a picture of the Xcode schema editor, but it's a list with a text box, and next to each element in the list, there's a checkbox. So you can define it, but keep it disabled, which means Xcode will not inject it when you run the application. But at least because it is in your project, when you really want to use them, they're already defined with the proper syntax. Again, like I said, it's only a text box. It's not a choice in a dropdown, or it's not an option you turn on. You have to type com.apple.coredata.concurrencydebug. And again, I'm not mentioning which letter are uppercase and lowercase here, just to keep this straight while talking. So the idea is you put them there, you leave them disabled, and when you need them, they are already there. You don't need to go through YouTube the videos. You don't need to go through the web to find them and, oh, what's the deposit? No, it's just there. Regarding shipping your application with the flagged enabled, I would say it might be a good way to find issues you struggle to reproduce it, but my vote will always be against shipping it enabled, because this flag is not just for your own code. If you have third-party code, and usually third-party binaries that you include in the application, so you don't really know they use core data, but they do, once the flag is on, it is on for your whole application process, including all the bundle framework you as the developer include or maybe are forced to include for a business need. And yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised. I don't remember years ago if we did that, but recently a team encountered that by accident. And I think the idea was the developers of that project originally kept it on because they were the only one using core data, and they never realized, like, they wanted to know if something would happen. But then this team added a new framework, and then guess what? There was an issue in the third-party library they added that was, again, crossing the threads in core data. So crash on prod was not fun for them, and they kind of learned the hard way of this lesson. But again, a crash in certain cases, especially this one, because the exception that is thrown is easily identifiable, is a good way to figure out your problem if you're not able to reproduce it, at the detriment of user experience for your customers. So keep that in mind. At this point, Yannick, do you have any questions?
Not really. Comments? Well, I'm not a core data user. I've used it for like 15 minutes. So
okay. So you never possibly used that tool, for example?
Last time I used it was like when it was introduced. So iOS 3 or 4.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So no. but you'll see, maybe the next tip I want to give to everybody, including yourself, might be more related to general database layer, but applied to core data. And the tip number 2 for today is called limit the amount of work to be done. And I think that is a general advice when you run into a performance problem. You have to figure out what is the work you're doing and how much can you stop doing that work, or how much can you limit the work you do to possibly bring back performance. Because if you're just doing operations for no reason, you're literally burning CPU, and that CPU can be used for something else. So it's important to be laser focused on the data you want out of your core data stack. And to be laser focused, you need to define a fetch request. And the fetch request is a request you send to core data to tell it, please give me data X out of what you have stored in you. And that you can do by using NS fetch requests. If you've ever worked with core data and you don't know about fetch requests, I don't think you've worked with core data, to be honest.
I've used them and I used it for 15 minutes, so.
Yes, exactly. I think, like I said, like usually in a persistence layer, you want to write data and you want to read data. So the only way to read data in core data's parlance is by generating fetch requests. The thing I want to discuss tonight, though, is NS fetch request, if you look at the documentation, it has a lot of parameters, a lot of attributes you can tweak on it. By default, you'll be used to tweak its entity property, you set a predicate, you set their sort descriptors. Those are the typical, because more or less what they tell to core data is like, I want data of type X. So let's say I store, again, cars in the garage. Like, I want all my cars, so like you say, I only want that data type. Then a predicate, I want my cars that are blue because I have an attribute that is called color. So that's where a predicate will be used to filter which data should be returned by the system. And then sort descriptor more or less describes how you want your data to be sorted in the results data sets that you receive out of core data. And those three properties are quite powerful, but the bare minimum for fetch requests. I think, though, there are a couple of other properties that you need to keep in mind, especially when you want to optimize the performance of application, or just when you start writing your application, that you need to keep in mind because you don't want to create performance issue. The first one that maybe people are less aware of is called result type. And that property defines how code data returns the result of the fetch request to you. And you'd be like, but I want my data. Like, why could I get different types of results out of core data? For sure, the default value is called manage object. And again, like concurrence type, it is an enumeration. So there are a limited set of values you can set to the result type attribute. Okay. Going back to the default value, the manage object is, again, you end up with a list of instances of NS manage object representing your cars in your model. To go back to my tip number one about making sure you don't cross streams, you don't cross data throughout the threads, you can also set your NS fetch request to return you directly NS object IDs by setting the result type to the enum value manage object ID. Super straightforward. You can then tweak that, end up with a list of NS manage object IDs, and then do the dance I was talking about, throw it to the other context, and in the other context, you can just do object for object ID and not have to do a fetch request because you have an ID. One thing I start to realize is that's the only way you can fetch data out of core data without using a fetch request is when you have the object ID. The other type that could be useful to cross thread boundaries, but still a bit dangerous though, is because you still have access to underlying data, is the dictionary return time. As its name suggests, it kind of gives you a JSON-like but more of a key value representation of your data based on NS dictionary. Usually, most of the NS like dictionary, NS number, things like that are kind of saved cross threads. But again, I would be cautious to use that as an excuse to take your data from one thread to another. But for sure, because you don't end up with a real NS manage object instance, it's less problematic if I dare to go there.
Wouldn't the object just be immutable anyway? Or is that not a thing anymore in Swiftland?
My assumption is you would end up with an NS dictionary, not an NS mutable dictionary. Right. So, and you don't have also the wrapper that is an NS manage object
correct
instance. So that could help. But again, I guess the reason I'm walking on this is I kind of forgot to research what are the safe or how safe it is to cross those objects, like cross the thread with those objects. I know in Swift you do have sendable conformance is kind of what they're doing that with async await, but I forgot to be totally transparent. What's the deal with NS base object foundation from the foundation framework?
Pretty sure that they're if they're immutable, they're safe, but
I think you're correct.
Do your research to be sure.
Yes. I think you're correct, but as you might expect now, it is a rare result type. I've rarely used it in my own usage. So that's why I guess my usage of it was limited, so I don't have that much experience with it. But I think you're correct, but that's why I'm still walking on it, because I don't want to give too much bad advice on that result type. Lastly, the last result type is a count result type, which is pretty straightforward. They just give you whether there's objects or not and how many. So again, to go back to the theme of this step is that if the idea is you have a fetch request to show the number of cars in your garage, why fetch all the cars metadata from your persistence layer when you just want to say two cars? So a fetch request with the count result type will give you that. The two other properties I want to look at from NS fetch requests are called fetch limit and fetch offset. Fetch limit allows you to limit the number of results the fetch request will return, whereas fetch upset says, okay, I want to start at the fifth element from your real data set. So let's say a fetch request would originally return 10 results. If you say fetch offset 5, it will start returning you the fifth and the later results and ignore the result 1 to 5, I guess, or 0 to 5. I kind of realized I did index 0 mistake in that sentence, but you get the idea here.
Usually people just combine those two to make some bare bones pagination stuff.
Yes, agreed. Or the best way is that you know your system might contain 2 or 3 objects and you really want to get the first one. Let's say you want to only to go back to my car example, you only want to return the latest car that got, let's say, an oil change. So you sort maybe by the last oil change date and you know just want to get this one, or the inverse, which one is the next on the list to get an oil change, then that would be one way to use fetch limit. Fetch offset, I don't think I've ever used it. But if you come from the really relational databases background, you might want similar system like Enix mentioned to do pagination.
Yeah.
So that exists there.
That's how we used to do it with Link back at my old job.
Oh, yeah. Okay. The one from C#.
Yeah.
Yeah. The entity framework and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Good. Next property to look at, which is a quite important one because it is encompassing a weird implicit behavior of NS manage object context and NS fetch request, and it is called fetch batch size. So when you ask an NS manage object context to execute a fetch request, in most cases it returns you an NS array instance. The other cases, like count, it doesn't give you an array with just one item that is the count. It just gives you the count. So in all the result types that can give you more than one results, you'll end up with an NS array. But internally, Apple doesn't really mention how they've done this, but this is not a real NS array. This is literally a facade that acts like one, but it is not an array. The facade is implemented more or less as a database cursor. So at some point when you loop through the array, it might have to fetch data again from the backing layer to get the data you need, since it might not hold it all in memory. So that's why it might be important to tweak your data, your batch size, to allow optimization so that you might want to, let's say, fetch 50 objects, process them, and it's okay if you slow down at the 51 object you want to process and then be able to load it the next 50, so that if you need to process big data sets, you might want to tweak when you occur the performance cost of fetching the data from the backing layer. By default, the value is 0, which means disabling the batching behavior. So by default, it means that once you fetch data from core data using an NS fetch request, it all puts it in memory. So if you have 1 million objects or 1 million instances of a car in your system, they will all end up in memory. So that's why it's going to be important if you end up working with big data sets that you put a batch size. And again, the downside of it is, yes, you'll be using less memory when you first fetch it, but you'll incur a speed cost when you start processing or looping through those objects, because at some point it will have to fault your array, read the next batch, and then put it in your data set. And for you, this is all transparent. You have to deal it, like, you don't have to do next page or like lower level relational database framework. Like, this is for you, but you need to be aware of that internal cost.
I'm somewhat surprised that it's not the opposite. I guess it's because it started on the Mac, maybe, but I would have assumed that if you have this sort of fake NS array that can fetch stuff dynamically, you would lazily load every single result. I guess maybe for performance reasons, it would just suck too much.
I don't know, but I just know that that's kind of what it does, sadly.
Yeah.
So you really have to be careful about fetching data in core data, especially when you have big data sets. I think in general, when it's kind of simpler application, that might be more okay. But let's put it this way, I work on app that can have big data sets like a customer database or an inventory. Without going into too much details, like you might end up with quantity of products in 5, 6, 7 digits.
Yeah, so
caching that in a core data stack means you have to be performant on that, and you might end up tweaking the batch size so that you can tweak this batching behavior.
If I remember correctly, on Entity Framework, it was the complete opposite, like I mentioned. It's completely lazy every time by default.
Right. Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised your feeling about it, because Corella started on the Mac first. That could make a bit more sense. But yeah, you have to be careful. Last property that you might or be less familiar with that I want you to be aware of is called Properties to Fetch. And this property is another one at the crux of the themes for this step. Literally limit the amount of work. If you don't need specific data associated to an entity, it's cheaper to not fetch it than to fetch it and not use it. Of course, this is another property that only works if you have a specific result type. And you might not be surprised to hear that it only works when you have a manage object result type or a dictionary result type, because again, this is configuring which properties you want to get data from your entity. So the other result type are not really returning you the real data. They're just returning you some metadata of a specific entity. Okay, so coming back to our two big important properties on an SFetch request, predicate and sort descriptor, you have to be careful in what you describe in both of these. Because depending on what you ask core data to do for filter and sort operation, so for predicate and sort descriptor, you might end up forcing it to do in-memory operation, and those are slow, especially compared to super optimized database or relational database based operation. In the context of core data, this means that when you use its SQLite backing, you want to make sure that you use as much database operation from SQLite to filter and sort your data. The issue is that you might be surprised that CoreData might do in-memory operation for filtering and sorting. And it's important to remember that CoreData supports three backing store technologies. I mentioned one, SQLite, which might be the most familiar one for CoreData, but it also supports XML backing and binary backing. And the CoreData API is designed to abstract these differences, but in the end, it does interpret your predicate and your sort descriptor for you, and it tries to convert them into what it knows about SQLite's SQL dialect, so that it knows, okay, I know SQL support those operation in SQL, so I can do those SQL statement.
One other thing I believe is true, and I don't know if this is what you're leading to, but you can do weird key value fuckery with your NS objects, and NS predicate can tap into that. And if that is not something that can be directly interpreted by the database, it can completely screw your performance over, I believe.
Yes, that's literally okay. What I'm leaning to, but you're about a section in the future.
Okay, well, sorry for spoiling it.
No worries, but before you figure out that CoreData might have done something less performant behind your back, you need to be able to measure that a specific operation is not performant. And especially, you have a less optimal fetch operation, because most cases, you'll end up saving too much information or not enough, or you end up fetching too much or not enough. So this is when the instrument application from the developer tools comes to the rescue. You can play with your app and big data sets and kind of get a general feeling, oh yeah, when I have, let's say, 100,000 cars in my garage, like my app feels slow. So my kind of like maintenance monitoring app is slowing down, but slowing down by how much? Like, is it just a feeling? Is that just a perception? instruments will be able to provide you with real numbers to show you slow operations. So what I suggest is that when you encounter this, or just generally when you develop a core data app, is that every couple of time you do launch, or maybe once you're done developing a feature that relies on your core data persistence layer, you do launch instrument and you create a new recording. So if you're less familiar with instruments, it is a debugging tool from Xcode that, depending on the template you choose, and we'll come back to templates, you run your application and it records additional data that you can then look at. So in our case, we'll create a new recording and we'll choose in the template picker the core data template. And this template allows you to record that core data specific information. So first, it will record the data faults. So anytime you try to access an NSManage object instance or the proxy array I was talking about, and the data is not in memory. So it asks to fetch it to the backing store, which can take some time compared to just reading memory. Second, it will also record all the fetch requests executed by your application, sort them by entity, their duration, and the number of objects returned. Lastly, it will also record the number of times your app has to execute a save operation on an NSManage object context, and how long did it take the app to do such save operation. For sure, for save operation, they can be lengthy because they need to go from the app memory to the backing store, possibly on this with SQLite. So you really need to strike the right balance between saving too frequently. So saving, you modify an object, you save, modify an object, you save, and not saving enough. Well, let's say creating a big transaction of changes and then saving them, which might create a long-standing save operation to your backing store. On top of this core data specific information, instrument records the call tree of all these operations. So let's say we have a fetch request that takes 10 seconds to execute. That's utterly too slow. So you'll be able to see that my car, to go back to my example of 100,000 cars, you would see that I am trying to get all my cars at a specific timestamp in the app. And if I click on it, I will also be able to see in instrument which call three, which part of my code base is generating this fetch request and trying to execute it and slow down. So this call tree is really important because it can guide you in certain area of your code base to pinpoint to a possible performance problem. So at this point, you have your recording set up, so it's time to start recording. You run your application a bit like what we were discussing with the previous debug flag. You just go through your application, whether you do some tests, whether you just run with the big data sets, whether you execute the steps a customer have reported, and then you record. At the end of the day, at the end of it, you stop and then you start analyzing the data. Hopefully at that point, you will have found a potential problem to solve. And that brings us to our second debug flag that I want to talk about. So for the sake of this conversation, let's assume we have found a called three, which is a spot where we execute a fetch request. Are you really surprised that we have found a problematic fetch request in the section where we talk about fetch requests?
No.
Thank you. So we need to config. Now at this point, what you need to confirm is whether core data properly translate your NS fetch request into the most appropriate SQL statement. And to do just that, we'll use the second core data debugging tool. And again, it's another flag that we mentioned that needs to be passed in as a command line argument. And the name of this flag is com.apple.coredata.sqldebug, and after that you need to pass in the value 4. The value 4 for this flag is important. The first flag was more of you set the 1 because it's yes or no, it's an on and off flag, but this one expects a value. I don't ever recall seeing documentation of the expected values.
Of course not.
4 is the biggest one I've ever seen. And every time I hear people talk about it, whether it's Apple engineers or others, it's a 1-4 value. And they describe the level, the amount of log you want to see. So like if we use more programmer, like you want verbose versus info versus warning, but they don't use those naming, they just say 1-4. And 4 means all the logs, more or less. So when you run your application with this flag set to 4, it is important to look at Xcode's console, because CoreData will start outputting generated SQL statement that it will use to do your operation to its SQLite backing. Again, this is only important if you do use a SQLite backing. In theory, this is not a problem you will encounter with other backing technologies, but I'm quite surprised if you use the other backing technologies in CoreData.
If the binary backing is somehow generating SQL statements, you've got a big problem on your hands.
Yes. Oh, yes. At that point, this is where you really need to be familiar. And I think you also need to be familiar with the concept of relational databases, because even if CoreData is not really a relational database framework, it's more of an object relational manager, ORM, it ends up transforming the operation it needs to do into relational database speak. And that's why you need to be familiar with that. And also the SQL language and SQLite's dialect of SQL to ensure that CoreData is translating your predicates, your cert descriptor correctly, or your fetch request correctly. So for your predicate, you need to understand how a where clause work and what it would look like. The same applies to sort descriptor being translated into order by or maybe possibly group by clauses. There are other properties on NSFetch request that needs to be converted correctly into SQLite statement, like the fetch limit that will be transformed into a limit clause, or the offset, the fetch offset into an offset clause. Same thing for properties to fetch. CoreData is not using the select star, which means select all the columns of a specific table. It will enumerate each column that it wants to select, even if it's selecting everything. So that's also where you would look at your select clause and make sure that if you have removed or if you have specified properties to fetch, that it is really only fetching that, because you don't want the CoreData framework to more or less process this data, even if you don't really use it. Now that you do have log outputs with SQL statement in it, you also need to ask yourself a couple of questions. And one of them I just mentioned is like, is the SQL statement fetching the right entity and attributes? Like, also, if you're not getting the right data or it's crashing because it's not getting the right objects, maybe it's because you just use the wrong entity. And ask how I know. Sometimes you make mistakes like these. Is my predicate included in the SQL statement? And is it the exact same filtering condition? And this is really important, because if it's not the exact same filtering condition, like is my car.color is blue. So that can be translated correctly into SQL statements. If it's not doing that in its where clause, CoreData might and strongly might be relying on in-memory filtering, and that could explain why this fetch request is slow. So at this point, it's literally asking SQLite to give it all the data of this table, and then in-memory, it would apply this filtering for you. That's not something you want. The same logic needs to be validated for your sort descriptor. If your order by clause doesn't appear in your SQLite statement, excuse me, or it's not exactly the same sorting condition, there might be in-memory sorting, and that's not what you want. Is SQLite using indexes, or is it scanning the whole table to do said filtering or sorting? A quick aside to talk about indexes, which I will quickly glance at, but indexes are, if you didn't know, additional data stored by a relational database to improve fetch operation speeds, and is a pretty well-known metadata to improve read performance of relational databases. For sure, there's a cost to that, and it's more data being stored on disk, but I think the cost for that of like way more read speed or read performance is well worth it. In the corded verbiage or parlance, they are called fetch indexes. So if I just don't say fetch indexes and just say indexes, assume they are the same thing. My suggestion is for any attributes part of your predicate should be an index. So to use my example of the car, so let's say I have car, color, and year. Let's say I have color and year in my car entity. So if I do car is blue and year is 2023, my index should include both attributes to ensure that I have a proper filtering condition. And this logic also applies to your sort descriptor. It's important that you both have indexes for your predicate and your sort descriptor to make sure that Corneta uses those faster operations to give you your data. You might also have to rely on data normalization when SQLite cannot do certain data comparison. The best example I can give you, and I've encountered it maybe once or twice, is that is normalizing a person's name because you want to exclude diacritics, because the SQLite string compare method is diacritic sensitive and it does not contain, does not support the contain square brackets CD syntax, which is more or less how you specify diacritics insensitivity in an NS predicate form. So I don't want to go into big details about that, but I think it's just an example of saying like, A, there might be cases, and this is one of them, where, as I mentioned, part of your predicate is not getting transformed into a where clause. So if you have to deal with this, especially because of accepted characters or diacritics, you have to normalize that string and then search on that string or filter on that string. So that's kind of the fix we had to deal with, is literally you duplicate the attribute, you then you normalize it, and then this is the attribute you use, part of your search predicate, and then you use the real attribute in your UI. And it's not fun to do, let me tell you about this. Once you've have added indexes, it's important to confirm that they're also used by Cordata. So true. In the log statements that I was mentioning about, you end up seeing what is called a query plan, which is how the database say, hey, I've received this SQL statement, and here's what I'm about to do with it. And that's also how you can see whether it's using, I know in SQL, they're using like in-memory B3s when you don't have indexes, or you'll be able to read a using index clause in that query or plan saying, hey, I'm using this index to do this filtering.
Do you know if the SQLite query plans tell you, hey, you can optimize this query by using this index? Because I know SQL Server did that and it was very useful in my old job.
Oh, let's say if you have an index but you don't use it. Oh,
no. Not even. If you don't even have the index, it'll tell you, hey, you could optimize the performance of this query by adding this index. Do you want to add it? Yes or no?
Oh, no, I've never seen this in those logs.
Unfortunate, because that was really one of the coolest features of the SQLite tools. Not SQLite, sorry. SQL Server tools.
Yes, I can imagine. Yeah, that it realized that you're doing something bad. Yeah, again, and that's kind of the goal of this episode, is to discuss those tools, because sadly, those guardrails doesn't exist. And that's a good guardrail from SQL Server. I'm a bit surprised that saying something Microsoft did is good, but I guess we're there tonight.
SQL Server, honestly, is really solid. I can't say I've had a bad time with SQL Server. I've had a bad time with bad uses of it, but the technology itself is pretty damn good.
Yeah, and I'm just trying to be mean for the sake of being mean, because I really never use SQL Server in my I was about to say my professional life, but I think not even at school. I don't think we use it in CJEP. So
yeah. Let me just add a correction. It's very good until you hit the paywall where you need to upgrade to an enterprise license that costs $1 million. That sucks. But everything else is fine.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that's not a fun conversation to have with your boss. That's, hey, we need to upgrade our SQL Server license.
Yeah.
Good. So that was the last comment or question that you should ask yourself when you have when you look at those log outputs to confirm whether what you're asking Core Data to fetch is really doing what you asked it to do. And the gist of it is sometimes you have to ask it to do things that might not make sense at first, so that they're you rely on operations that are a bit more performant to get the performance out of it. And that's why I think in the end, while Core Data is a good abstraction on top of backing their technologies, you still have to massage your high-level API to do the proper translation. And this second tip, with all of its tools and debug tools and tips, is around that. Is you end up having to massage the way you use Core Data for it to work with an SQLite backing. So that's that. But in most cases, from what I've seen, like, it's really when you go into big data sets or specific issues with big data sets that you have to do that. So to conclude, to have a performant Core Data application, you need to remember to not cross the threads with data. Limit the amount of work to be done, and quite importantly, measure the performance of the application by debugging it using strengths and using the Core Data debug flags. So I hope that with these tips that you've learned something you didn't know about Core Data, and that you'll end up shipping better applications to your customers. That's it for me.
Alrighty. You can find all of the show notes for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/203, or you can find our complete back catalog of episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. The show is on the Fediverse. We are at limipo_podcast@mastodon.social. You can also find us individually on the Fediverse. I am at Socarina at icosahedron.website, and you can find Ducolivier at
Luco, L-U-C-C-O, at mastodon.social.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.